Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Carrie Adloyd. How do we grieve for someone? How does it change and evolve as we get older? My dad died when I was 15, and it took me many, many years to be able to express what I had gone through. So I decided to create Griefcast, a chance to talk, share, and laugh about the weirdness of grief and death. But with comedians, so it's not that depressing, I promise. Each time I talk to a different comedian about their own personal experience of grief, as we remember someone that they have lost along the way. Whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club, this is a chance to talk about the peculiar human process of death. Welcome to Griefcast.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, Griefsters. Guess what? I hope you're having an okay week. I'm having an okay week. I went to the seaside. That's always good for clearing up the cobwebs, as old ladies like to say, and now me. Just a reminder, we have a live episode coming up June the 6th at the Udderbelly Festival on London's South Bank. I will be joined by Jeff Lloyd from the Reasons to be Cheerful podcast, Camille Youcam from Birthday Girls podcast and Channel 4's Lee and Dean, and the incredible stand-up Josie Long as well, who hosts Shortcuts. If you enjoy the show, I can almost guarantee you will enjoy four people sitting around chatting about death some more. So head to the Udderbelly website for tickets. This week I'm talking to stand-up, writer, broadcaster, general legend, Arthur Smith. Arthur is known as the self-appointed Night Mayor of Balham. He hosts BBC Radio 4 Loose Ends. He hosts BBC Radio 4 Extras Comedy Club. He's been going to Edinburgh for so many years, I can't even give you the number. And he's generally just an incredible, brilliant, hilarious man that consistently, authentically remains Arthur Smith. Arthur came in to talk to me mainly about his dad, Sid. Welcome to Griefcast. I'm here today with comedian Arthur Smith. Hello.
Hello, Carrie.
I was just thinking, as we just started talking, your voice is incredible. You've got some, like, do you think it's improved with age?
I don't know. I think it has. It was a bit more nasal when I was younger. But
yeah.
Yes, people like my voice. I sometimes think
nice.
I should get myself a job where I just speak very quietly for people who are trying to go to sleep.
Yeah, it's nice.
Are you trying to go to sleep? Then I'm here to help you.
Off you go.
It's
nice and threatening at the same time. Yeah, it's really nice.
Well,
maybe that's because I've listened to you so much on the radio as well. Maybe I'm like, when you're used to a voice as well, it's quite nice, isn't it? Because you're like, oh yeah, I know that. Is it an impolite question to ask you, like, how long you've been doing comedy?
It certainly isn't an impolite question, so feel free to ask me.
How long have you been doing comedy?
Well, it depends what you mean by doing comedy.
Yeah, yeah.
Or how long have I been paid for it, and how long have I been... Yeah. I mean, I was doing it since I was a little boy. I remember when I was about 8 or something, our teacher came in and said, we're going to do a production of Peter Pan for the school. And I thought, ooh. And then so I was so excited, I went home and wrote the script for what I thought it might be, which
That's
was
amazing.
Obviously unperformable, presumably. But she said, well, you can play any part you want. And I thought, I know, I'll be Captain Hook.
A good part.
Yeah, because, you know, and then I came on as Captain Hook with my you know, with my coats in with me, you know, me
coat hanger.
That my mother had fashioned for me, and brandishing it around trying to terrify everyone. But they all started laughing.
Yeah.
At which point I thought, oh, yeah, maybe that's what I meant to do.
But
it was
so
a long
nice.
Time before, I mean, I had, you know, I did a review at university and we went to Edinburgh.
Oh, wow.
And with that, we ended up doing radio series and things. But, I mean, I had lots of other jobs. I didn't go professional till I was about 30.
Oh, wow. What other jobs were you doing?
Well, I was a road sweeper.
Were you?
I was a dustman.
Oh, my God.
A postman. And I taught English to foreign students.
Oh, wow.
That was a really good job looking back on it, because it makes you very attentive to your own language, and you also, you know, get a sense of other languages and other nationalities, because I taught all nationalities. I remember one day it started snowing outside the class when I was teaching, and it turned out three of the class had never seen snow.
One was
from Iran and one was from Iraq. It was before that war. And they were so excited, I just abandoned the lesson. We all went out into the snow. And you've never seen three people so excited at seeing snow.
That's so nice.
Yeah, it was a wonderful moment.
My brother,
I enjoyed teaching, yeah.
That's what my brother used to do for a long time. He taught English as a foreign language. And he was always having a go at me because I didn't realise till he started teaching that how colloquial I am. So when I would talk to people whose English is their second language, I was sort of like, oh, you know what I mean? Like, it's kind of that sort of thing. And he would be like, carry on, you can't, like, that is so unhelpful. Be clear.
Not only be clear, you also have to avoid anything too idiomatic.
Yeah, I'm full of, literally, that's all I speak in is metaphors, colloquialisms and slang. Like, that's my language.
Well, then, yes, you can't do that if someone doesn't speak English.
No, it's not very fair, is it?
If you like, I will speak to you in the manner of an English teacher.
Yes, please.
Who you could understand very well, even if you didn't speak English, Carrie.
Yeah,
and
nice.
I will not use any funny little idioms. They might not know what idiom means.
Depend what
level you're at.
Yeah. No, I think you're okay here. I think otherwise, I can only operate on slang, really. So I'll get stuck. Wow. So it wasn't until you were 30 then you started. I'm going to do this comedy lark all the time. Was that a choice?
I think by then I would. I mean, I'd already done a fair bit. I mean, there was a brief period where I was teaching, and I was being on the telly. And I once gave my class the homework of answering questions about my performance on the telly the previous evening.
Well, and they had to practice their English.
Yeah.
Did you say, was Arthur good?
No, I never actually said it. It was more a question of the tenses and
questions.
Oh,
that's so sweet.
Because you get to realise all the different tenses. It's useful to know the grammar of your own language.
Yeah.
I know the difference between the present simple, the present continuous, the past perfect, the pluperfect, the conditional, the three conditionals, et cetera.
Yeah, my brother does as well, and he's always slightly picking me up because I have an English degree and I don't know any of those things. And sometimes in grammar, he'd be like, no, that's not how you'd say that. I'm like, oh, but it sounds fine. It sounds all right, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, he's right. You're right. You're both right,
in a
way. There's a correct one. But if people can understand you, it doesn't really matter,
thing,
does it?
That's the main thing. Thank you for saying we're both right. Well, that normally solves an argument, as long as both of us are right. So what was... What was your first gig then? Was it the Edinburgh Review or like?
No, well, I suppose it depends. My first gig at universities, I mean, we did put on reviews there.
Right.
But I suppose first sort of big public gig, well, it was at the Edinburgh Fringe in 1977.
Wow, was it tiny then? Was that when Edinburgh was tiny?
Well, I mean, the city was still the same size. But
relatively,
it was still.
And then they built so much more.
Yeah, that's right. Ever since the Fringe time, well. To give you an idea, there were about, I mean, it was still quite big. It was still a big thing. There were something like 40
Sorry,
comedy shows.
I didn't mean
shows.
Tiny in a...
No, yeah, I know. It was. There were about 40 comedy shows, probably.
Because now there's about 2,000.
Yeah.
There? Yeah.
But of those, and no one was doing stand-up then, though. They were, it was all reviews, they used to call them, was a group of 40 sketch shows, essentially.
Yeah. God.
Stand-up didn't really arrive till the early 80s.
Wow. But it did exist as a thing, but just not in.
Well, there were the stand-up that existed then was people like Jim Davidson, Bernard Manning, Stan Baldwin.
Yeah,
it was very male, very sparkly dinner jacket, very troops of jokes marching by, often about you know, that were racist or homophobic or sexist. So the new comedy, as it were, alternative comedy, alternative cabaret, as it started out as, was sort of came sort of with the arrival of Thatcher and the opening of the Comedy Store, which were about the same time. And there was a real division then in the country that's hard to imagine now, I think, between, you know, you either hated Thatcher or you loved her. She was very divisive. In an odd way, it's a bit like that now, I suppose.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's pretty either you love Brexit or you hate Brexit. Yeah. Like, it's we do like a yes or no, don't we, English people? We do like a, what are you? What side do you on? So then I can judge where I am in status to you.
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, and back then there was like the Falkland War, where, it was virtually, it was quite shocking if you were against it, as most of us in the comedy circuit were. It was quite a left-wing thing then, comedy. Yeah. And it was deliberately trying to purge the racist and sexist themes of the previous bunch.
Yeah. God, it's I find it absolutely fascinating, the history of it culturally. Obviously, I'm just wary that I'll just start talking to you about the history of comedy. That's not why we're here.
No.
But it's very interesting. So, Arthur, who are we remembering today?
Well, I think principally my father, but it occurs to me that I always remember when I first became aware of the idea of death and what it meant, really, was when I was about 8 or 7 or something, not long before my appearance as Captain Hook. I had a little friend in this block of flats we lived in.
Is this in London?
In London, in Bermondsey.
Right.
And then one day she wasn't there, and I told that she died, and I just didn't... I think it was then I realised, oh, I see, so anyone can die. Oh, I see, so probably my mum and dad will die sometime, and my brothers, oh, and me as well. It was the kind of realisation that death existed, which I think you don't really understand until you're about 7 or something.
Well, that's still quite young, I think, to have that kind of, like, that's quite a deep philosophical realisation at 7 or 8. Some people take ages to get there.
Well, some people, well, I don't know. I think that's why the Catholic Church, they'd say, don't they, give me a child to the age of 7. I think there's a crucial turning point around there when you understand that you're going to die.
What had happened to her? Do you remember?
I only found out years later it was leukemia or something like that. Yeah.
So and they told you she's died and that was it?
Yeah, she's gone, and I didn't really understand it. And I'd been, you know, she'd been my little friend. Yeah. And how could she? She was younger than me. How could that happen?
God.
But I suppose, obviously you don't go through life without people dying around you. But I've been quite lucky. But I suppose, the biggest moment for me, the most significant death, first significant death, was my father.
And what was his name?
Sid Smith.
That is such a good name.
Yeah.
It's a great name.
Where we're sitting here now in South London, he would have been a policeman on patrol around here. He was PC Sid Smith of Kennington Metropolitan Police. Although before then, he had had the most horrific experience in the war.
Oh, right.
He was called up at the age of 19, sent to Scotland, where he was put on a boat with a load of troops, and they went on a boat on an American troop ship all the way around Africa to North Africa. So they went right the long way round because you couldn't go, because at the time the Mediterranean was in the control of the Germans. All the way around to North Africa, and he fought in the Battle of El Alamein.
Wow.
And he was captured there. And from there, him and his fellow POWs were paraded through the streets of Palermo, then sent to some ghastly camp in Italy where his weight, and he was about the same size as me, went down to 6.5 stone, and they'd eat rats. And then he went and worked as slave labour down a copper mine for a year in Saxony. And then he finally ended the war at Colditz Castle. Well, he went to another place, then Colditz Castle, which became a very famous, because there was a film about it and then a TV series, because it was a famous place where they sent people who tried to escape, although my father ended up in that, and it was mainly for officers. So my dad's job was really to kind of wipe the arse of the posh blokes who were in there.
Wow. Oh, my God.
And then finally they were liberated by the Americans. And I was thinking, God, what a moment that must have been. You know, we won't ever experience a moment of, God, the gates opening and American troops coming in and the German guards have put their arms down.
Oh, yeah, it's
being free, my God, after 2.5 years he'd been in prison.
Yeah, I've talked about my grandpa was captured in, he was in Changi Jail, which is, so he was captured by the Japanese and was when he came back to Wales was, like 6 stone.
Yeah.
And I've seen a newspaper clipping of them all. And
how long was he in there?
He's in there a good part of the war. He got captured quite early.
Yeah.
I think it was
he must have seen so many people die around
Oh my God, so many. And it was like that Welsh battalion all got sent over there, and I think not many.
When you say
came
battalion,
back. Sorry, what do I mean?
Battalion.
Battalion.
I'm sorry, I'm turning to your brother.
No, battalion. What's battalion? Is that American?
Am I
just saying it wrong? I'm actually
think
blushing.
You've just invented a word. It's nice
it
though.
It sounds nice, battalion. Doesn't it? Battalion.
Yeah, I think it's more of an adjective.
Okay.
Her magnificent battalion stance.
Oh, okay.
I'm just making that up.
No, I liked it. Did
your granddad ever talk to you about it?
Yeah, he did. We've talked on the show. He was very, he was captured by the Japanese and was in Changi Jail for, I think, like 3-4 years.
It was,
something.
As long as
it was a long time. And he was the first, once he came back to Wales, he was one of the first people to welcome a Japanese person into his house.
Oh, what a splendid man.
Yeah,
my
he was.
Because that
was,
must have been hard for a lot of those guys.
It was really hard. And we've got a recording of him telling this amazing story where the sort of local hotel lady comes to him and says, Mr. Lloyd, I've been asked to have a Japanese man. I don't want him there because obviously so many Welsh people have died in this area. Mm. And he said, nope. We must have them. We must show them hospitality. We must show that it's not, because his big thing was once he saw how the Japanese officers treated their soldiers, he said that was a big turning point. Before that, he hated the Japanese. He said, I thought they were evil. And then the story he always told was a soldier was running, pulled up to do an errand, left the car running, the engine running, and then he jumped out and got something and then got back into the car, and an officer saw him, and because he'd left the car running, he'd wasted the petrol, and he dragged him out of the car by his hair basically and just beat the shit out of him.
Ugh.
And my grandpa watched this and he said it was a real moment. He thought, God, if that's how you treat your own people, then this isn't about, they're not evil.
My father always had a respect for Germans, actually, because anyway, as far as he was concerned, when he was treated relatively well at Colditz, because he was under the Geneva Convention, and he saw Russians, for example, who had it far worse because they weren't under the Geneva Convention.
Wow.
And my father was, because I do a bit, I'm doing a show about him, and there was a moment when I took him back to Colditz, and
oh wow.
When he was 70, and it was just around, we joined the EU, and he wanted to say, yes, I want to be a part of the EU.
Wow.
Go, because there's a bit in my show where because I got him to write his memoirs before he died, and he talks about flying back to England after this 2.5 years and going over the White Cliffs of Dover. And it all sounds like you could imagine Brexiteers having a real wank over this. But actually, my dad was all for the European Union. I mean, from that generation, the previous two world wars had started in amongst European nations.
Yeah.
So it seemed like quite a good idea that instead of all being enemies, we all become mates. And
that's my grandpa was very much. It's like it wasn't. Mm. It was people above you making bad, stupid choices. But that's
absolutely
not what we were here for.
My father, when he was captured, he told the story of he was helping an injured British soldier. And he was surrounded by Italian guards, and then the Italian doctor dealt with this man, and the Italian doctor took out a picture of his children and said, Hitler, Mussolini, no good. And my dad, in response, said, Churchill, no good. And they kind of bonded in a way, those two. That was just ordinary people together, ordinary men and bollocks to all the powers that be that has put them in that position.
So he talked about it then quite freely with you.
Yes, I mean, he had his sort of regular set of stories, but you get to know the. But yes, he did talk about it, and people, because of course, when the film was made, suddenly everyone was interested in Colditz particularly. Wow. So he became a bit of a sort of mini local celebrity and got asked to do talks about it and whatnot. And then, yeah, I took him back to Colditz Castle when he was 70, yeah.
Wow, that must have been an incredible experience.
Yes. I'll always remember the words he said when it first came into view, this big old ancient castle where he'd been a prisoner, hadn't seen it for 4 years. He looked at it and he said, "There it is." That's one of the gags from the show. Right? But yes, I mean, I think it's impossible for us really to understand the lives of our parents before we were born.
Yeah.
But, you know...
Especially in wartime, yeah. I mean, it's a very, very, well, yeah, hopefully distant time.
Yeah.
So how old was he when he died?
He was a reasonable age in a way. He was 81.
Wow.
And he'd, he'd smoked fags all his life, although he was never much of a drinker. But I remember how it happened. Me and my partner were on our way to a dinner party in a taxi, and I got a call from my mother saying, Sid's coughed up blood and he's in hospital. And we went to see him. We immediately went down to Bath, where they were living then. Mm. They retired to Bath. And the next day we went, and then we were sent away while the doctors talked to him. And then it was apparent that, you know, he didn't have long left. And I walked in and sat with him. And the first thing he said was, "She's been a wonderful wife. You'll look after her, won't you?" That was his first thought.
Oh.
Mm. And then he came home. And he died at home. And in the last few weeks, he got really desperately sad. And I remember coming down one night for a piss in the middle of the night, and I saw him and sitting there, and he said, "I'm desperate." But then somehow, I think that happens, he seemed to go off into another sort of zone almost slowly, where he was sleeping more and more. And then I remember one afternoon, I went up and he was in bed, you know, asleep mostly, and, you know, he didn't have that long, and we were being helped by Macmillan nurses and whatnot. And he said, "I've been thinking about religion." And I said, "What?" And he said, "Oh, never mind." He went back to sleep. And then I realised he'd said, "I've been thinking about religion."
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, he'd never been a religious man particularly. And so I went back and he was still asleep. And I said, "Well, I don't know what happens to us in the end, Sid, Dad, but, you know, maybe you'll be off cycling to Devon again with your old friend Morris, and then maybe Hazel, that's his wife, my mother, will come by eventually, and then we'll all come by in the end." And I kind of thought I detected a little smile, and then he died that night. So I choose to believe that, however possibly erroneously, that I'd left him with an image of something that he could go to.
Yeah, that's really beautiful.
Yeah, he was much loved. He was a hugely popular man. I feel so privileged that I had him as a father. When I see some of my, you know, friends, parents, or the terrible troubles they've had, or people who've had abuse, or their parents died. I mean, in a way, I sometimes think that my comedy career has suffered because I had such a nice dad who lived to a decent age.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, it does fire people up, doesn't it, when they have a shit dad?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite surprising if you look at the number of comedians
whose
one of their parents died very young, or abused them, or left them, or...
I mean, that's how this show survives, Arthur.
Yeah.
I'd be really in trouble if it wasn't causing people to go into comedy. My mum listens, and she always, like... For a while, she'd always say, "It's always the dad, isn't it? They've all lost their dad really young." And I was like, there's obviously a theme developing here. Yeah, I think it does, deep trauma does, you know, cause comedy.
Well, I know
it doesn't
not just comedy. I mean, there's any number of artists and writers.
Yeah.
If you look at them, they've had a mother or a father who died young or left them. Or, you know, Eddie Izzard, Alan Davis. And Picasso, probably. I made that one up.
we'll take it.
Actually, my mother, too. See, in a way, I'd like to talk about my mother because she never lived alone. You know, she was from that generation. The day she got married, she moved out of the house and moved in with my dad. You know, and she moved out of the family house.
Yeah.
And then there she was, and she could be feel herself tipping into dementia, which you know, which her mother had had and her sister as well. Wow. And she was, it was desperately sad for her, and she just obviously thought, "Oh, what the fuck!" and started drinking 3 bottles of wine a day.
Wow.
And then she was forgetting where, you know, I used to get phone calls saying she'd been found wandering about, and oh, you know, and in a sense, my mother's descent into dementia was another kind of grieving I had to do. But then actually, fortunately, that's turned out all right in a way, because we realised, yeah, we had to put her somewhere, although she didn't really want to go. But now she's in a home and she's in the dementia wing. And she's just sublimely brilliant.
Really?
Because, you know, I realise with dementia, you know, people say you should live in the moment, but if you can't remember what the last moment was, and you don't know what the next one's going to be, it's your only option.
Yeah.
And my mother remains very articulate. She was always a clever sort of grammar school working class girl. And even now, I go and see her often, and she'll start on a sentence that appears to be making sense, and the trees will come and look. That's nice, isn't it? Because I remember something similar when I was a girl, wasn't it? I'm there reconstructing the kind of sentences my mother delivers. But actually, she says, "Hello, dear," and she's beloved by the carers because she's lovely to them all. And, you know, she goes for a little walk every day. And she doesn't know what Brexit is. She's never heard of Donald Trump.
You can see the attraction, can't you?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I do a joke, which is true, though. I was once sat watching the news with her, and she said, and it was awful, you know, and I said, "Oh, what a terrible world we live in." And my mother said, "Yes, I would hate it." Which is a sort of understandable world. But so, in fact, now, you know, she was so desperately in grief and misery after my father died.
Well, yeah, they must have been married for such a long time.
Yeah, and then, so over 50 years.
Wow,
yeah.
It's like you said, it's this, that slightly, it's almost impossible to imagine that these days, isn't it? Because people don't marry that young, and that way that your life would have just gone from family to creating another family.
Yeah.
My granny and granddad on my mum's side, when my granddad died, my granny died 2 weeks later.
Really?
And everyone just said she just went, "No."
Yeah. Yeah,
I'm just not doing it.
That was probably, I mean, that's not an uncommon story.
Yeah, it's not at all. And you can understand when you have, what world do you know without them? Like, it must be
well,
very
for my crazy. Mother, she just wanted to die. I mean, I think probably if she could have just taken a pill that would have quickly done for her, she probably would have done.
Yeah.
She certainly was all for, signing the do not resuscitate and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But it was quite a palaver because you have to get... you know, you have to essentially take over all her bank records and get, you know, responsibility for it. That was sad. That was a kind of grieving. But like I say, in a sense, we've come out the other end of that because she's just sort of, you know, joyous now. And she really doesn't care about dying, doesn't really know if she's going to, and would be entirely fine if she did.
That's kind of amazing, isn't it? Like you said, to sort of reach that place, it's...
But, I mean, as we live longer, you know, dementia is actually, it's, you know, because they've got no idea how to cure dementia, really. You know, that's going to become a big problem. Apparently 50% of people over 95 have dementia, half of people, and, you know, there's going to be more and more people living to a long age. Or maybe not. Maybe we're all going to be nuked tomorrow. In which case, eat, drink and be merry, for tomorrow we die.
That's it. Perhaps that's the plan. That's the government plan to make all these mistakes. So it could just be like, this will make old people care a lot easier. So how old were you when your dad died then?
Well, I was quite old. I was 47. So, I was very lucky
in
that sense that he lived to that age, especially given what he'd been through.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the fact that he'd been a smoker all his life.
So he'd seen you do the comedy. How did he feel about that?
Oh, he loved it to an almost embarrassing extent. My mother was a bit, very good.
Yeah.
But my dad, he couldn't resist. When I took him to Colditz that time, and I was being, you know, I was on lots of things then, he couldn't stop saying, "Hey, did you see him? He was on Wogan last week." And I had to say, "Oh, please, be quiet, Dad."
That's so sweet.
And there was one, maybe I should recite it for you, give you a chance to have a bit of a snooze. There was a poem I wrote, because I was always aware of the huge contrast between the fact when he was 21, he was in a prisoner of war camp eating rats. And I, at the same age, was being a student in Paris for a year.
Wow.
Teaching English as a foreign language in a French school and living the life of Riley.
Yes,
really,
I can imagine.
Or Riley in Paris. But nevertheless, I had a bit of a broken heart. And my father had a story that was a broken... Because not long after he was captured, they finally got letters from home. And when he'd gone away, my father was engaged to a woman called Edna.
Wow.
And he got two letters that were written 3 months apart, but he opened one after the other. And one said she was sorry she was seeing a Canadian airman. And the second letter, read immediately after, announced she'd married him.
Wow.
So he was not only in a 6.5 stone prisoner with no possible way of escaping, but he was also... he'd been dumped.
Yeah, his girl had left him. My God.
But I also, at the same time as I was that age, I had a bit of a broken heart from a woman who left me. So there was this one particular poem that I used to do sometimes that he loved of all the things I ever did. And I think it was a bit because he was a bit in the same situation, although far, far worse, obviously. So I will now recite it for you. Yeah, you can doze off for, it should be about 1 minute, 30 seconds. Okay. So here we are in Paris in spring, the lovers all love and the clochard all sing, but every morning through the 8 o'clock blue, the postman comes with nothing from you. There is the Arc de Triomphe, the Boulevard Saint-Michel, the Musée des Beaux-Arts, but no you. So I dip my croissant in my café au lait, I open the window and call in the day, but in spite of the Seine, the birds and the sun, it's no fun in Paris buying garlic for one. There is the Rue Mouffetard, the Jardin des Plantes, the Marché aux Puces, but no you. So I heave myself on the Clignancourt line, and the busker there, he sings so fine that I'm lost in the world of the metro men till I see you're not there and it hurts again. There is the Tour Eiffel, the Champs-Élysées, the Louvre, shut on Tuesdays, but no you. I ain't gonna live in Paris no more, get the 9:57 from the Gare du Nord, but whenever, wherever the train may go, you won't be there to kiss me hello. There'll be France, England, America, every place, all of them, without you.
I want to give you a little clap.
Thank you, Daria.
That's beautiful. I love that. That's amazing. So was that one of his faves?
That was his favourite of all the things I did, yeah. Because I think, like I say, he was stuck there abroad with a broken heart, like I say, in much more severe conditions. At least I could go home on the 9:57.
Yeah, exactly. You didn't have to eat a rat to get there.
No.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd.
Was he funny? Do you think that's
yes,
where you got it from?
Funny. He was a natural teller of anecdotes, wow. which I've discovered doing this show about him. Because he left this, we got him to write this memoir, which he wrote in his copper plate writing. And my mother corrected all the spellings and grammar. And so often there's a big punchline at the end of one of his stories. And he's got a lot of stories, apart from the war ones, which are not quite so funny, obviously. Although even there's some funny ones. He's got a funny bit about when he's in Colditz, when they were eating a little bit, the weight got up a bit. And he said, I found my sexual feelings began to return. And I discovered I rather fancied Ginger Story. But then I noticed, so did everybody else. Ginger was quite an ugly bloke, but he seemed to have some degree of femininity. And, I mean, it's really funny stuff. And some of his tales, being a copper on the South Bank, where he was constantly, I mean, he used to be on the beat in a way that you don't really see coppers anymore. And the night beats, he talks about how he was... he was doing the Lambeth Walk. He walked up and down Lambeth Walk, which is a road, not just a song, for 8 hours at a time at night. And then, you know, and there was really no one about then. And he described how he discovered there was a little shop where rats used to go in, and he stood outside with a bit of string, a bit of cheese on the end of the string with his truncheon as a way of entertaining, trying to bash a rat on the way out. Rats seem to feature quite heavily in my dad's life.
Yeah, heady days when there was not much to do of nighttime policing.
Yeah, well, having said that, you know, he mainly had to deal with drunks. He had lots of... he's got a funny story about a woman who came up and tried to kiss him outside the Old Vic where he was patrolling. And he was really embarrassed. He said, please go away. And then a little crowd gathered and she said, give us a kiss. You know, and someone had taken a picture of this. And in this show, I've got a picture of my dad in his 20s, standing there looking absolutely terrified in his copper's outfit with this little woman trying to kiss him. It's hilarious.
That's such a brilliant image. That's so amazing.
Well, yeah, and you get to see, you know, he had lots of police friends, and although he was deemed to be a bit unusual because he was one of the few policemen who was against hanging, voted Labour.
Yeah.
And also, because that was another thing at the time, people, obviously, it was illegal to be gay. And... he was once called to Waterloo Station when the transport police needed a proper copper to arrest a guy who'd been found, with some other bloke in the toilet or something. My dad really didn't want to arrest him, but he had to. And it was a doctor from St Thomas's who said to my dad brilliantly, "I'll tell you what, copper, if you ever spent a night with me, you'd never want another woman." Which really made my dad laugh. But he had to arrest him. But he really didn't want to. You know, he was a very liberal man.
Wow.
And also he was very popular with the Rastafarians who used to get arrested for smoking grass because as a child he had met Haile Selassie, the emperor. Because his dad was in royal protection at the time. And Haile Selassie had been, you know, had to leave Ethiopia.
Yeah.
And my granddad had to guard him, and apparently he was a very nice man, Haile Selassie, so he invited me granddad's family round for tea, and my dad went to
have dinner
and he used to drop this to the Rasta guys at the Kennington Nick, and they say, oh, Sid, you knew Haile Selassie, man, you know, he was a very popular, I remember as a child walking along the road with him once, and these two drunks came running. This is when he was off duty, came running at us. And I thought, oh, blimey. But they just ran past me and slapped Sid on the back and said, hey, Sid, is this your nipper? You know, he was a popular guy with the people he arrested. And he only arrested them. He didn't really like arresting people. He'd only arrest them if they really needed a sort of roof for the night.
It sounds almost sitcom like. It's so lovely. Do you know what I mean? It always sounds like you could see. Yeah.
Well, in a sense, there was a thing which you'll be too young to remember, Carrie Ever, called Dixon of Dock Green.
I've heard of it. Yeah. I don't remember watching it.
And
but
it was a bit like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was PC Smith of Kennington Nick, although he. You know, there was a lot of corruption in the police then, and he knew about it, but he didn't want to get involved in it. He was about the most honest man I ever knew, my father, I think.
Wow.
Because I always remember there was one incident when I was at university in my last year, and I'd become interested in the theories of Marcel Proudhon, the French anarchist, who said property is theft.
Right.
Which had led to me stealing a Cornish pasty. from the university campus.
I mean, you've got to start small.
Yeah.
Before you take the buildings off the, you know.
Yeah, but unfortunately, I was nicked on my first outing.
Oh, no.
And I was, you know, I was a proper student with a big afro and a sort of flared trousers made out of deck chairs and tie-dye T-shirt, a big greasy moustache, you know. And the police came and didn't like the look of me, obviously. And they were looking at my arms for needle marks. And I thought I was a drug addict.
Sort of Cornish pasty thing.
Yeah, I know. It seemed to be getting a bit out of... I just nicked a pasty. But then they took me down to the police station and said they were going to... And then I was sat in the police station and then they went away for a bit. And then one of them came back and said, "Is your father a policeman?" And I said, "Oh, no, I don't want my dad to know about this." But I said, "Yes." And he said, "All right, then, you can go." And I always thought, "Oh, thank you for that, Dad." Although I never told him that story.
If he was still alive,
I probably wouldn't have told him. But because my dad was a copper, I got...
But how did they know? Do you think someone just said?
Well, you know, they can look these things up,
can't
they?
Of course,
they know everything about you, Carrie.
Yeah, I'm being too trusting. How would the police know it? A fact.
They just ask Facebook and they'll tell them.
Wow, so they just checked and then they were like, "Oh, he's a copper's son."
Yeah.
And I guess, hopefully then, they went, "What's he done? He's only stolen a Cornish
pasty." Yeah, you would have thought, it seemed like they'd spent a lot of time. Yeah. I mean, I think they must have had some information about someone who looked like me who'd been up to much more no good than
nicking
a pasty. And I
guess arresting someone who looks like you at the time probably would have been good, wouldn't it? Be like, "Look at that. That's the sort of trouble we're trying to deal with."
Well, yeah.
Drug-taking students. Yeah, get them in the police.
Yeah,
station.
Oh, they didn't like the students, the Norfolk Constabulary.
Wow. That's very nice that he did something without ever knowing it.
Yeah. Although he did know when I got arrested in Edinburgh at the end of my late night alternative tour.
What happened then?
Me and Simon Munnery were arrested. I was charged with breach of the peace and possession of a megaphone because I'd been patrolling down.
Right.
But then the police were only there because a comedian called Malcolm Hardy had rung ahead, always used to ring up and tell the police that I was causing trouble at the start of these tours. Mate, Malcolm never got arrested. You ever heard of Malcolm Hardy?
I've heard of Malcolm Hardy.
There's a death that... his funeral, I would say, is about the best gig I've ever been to.
What happened at his funeral?
Well, you know, he was a bit of a legend.
He was famously
reckless. He used to run the notorious Tunnel Club where hecklers used to meet up beforehand and the show was all over in 15 minutes. Everyone had been booed off.
Wow.
This is at the start of the alternative comedy. Yeah. He was famous for urinating over the audience, doing his impression of General de Gaulle by taking his clothes off and putting glasses on the top of his knob, by his utter recklessness. There were so many stories of him breaking into zoos and he'd been in prison himself for 4 or 5 years for nicking cars and then started a pornographic Punch and Judy show, and then became a comedian, then ran the... And anyway, he drowned in the river, which was entirely appropriate because he lived by the river and his dad had been a Thames lighterman. And his funeral, it was quite unexpected, although kind of everyone knew he was so reckless. It was amazing he'd lived that long. And it was in St Alphege's Church in Greenwich, which is a rather grand... quite grand Victorian, older 18th century church, and there was me and the vicar were comparing, And
comparing, well, yeah, can you tell the vicar, have you done this sort of size gig before?
Well, it was like 10. Yeah, it was a bit like that. He and I had a bit of a, and we sang All Things Bright and Beautiful to start with. And it was full of every comedian who ever existed was there in that church that day, such that there couldn't have been any panel shows happening at all. And Jules Holland played. Joe Brown read a beautiful poem. Stuart Lee made a wonderful speech. And his famous catchphrases were oi oi, knob out, and fuck it. And there were all flowers arranged in those words the place. And then he was carried out of the church, his coffin to the tune Return to Sender. And it was just both hilarious and utterly moving and beautiful. It was just the most memorable gig.
That's so wonderful. I really love when, funerals should obviously reflect someone's life. And if someone is absolutely crazy, their funeral should be. And we had Adam Megiddo on the Showstoppers, and both him and I worked with Ken Campbell.
Oh, yeah.
Ken's funeral was...
Oh, I bet that was like...
Yeah,
that.
Equally... very mad, very, very mad. But then all anyone could say was, well, of course it was. Like, no one's surprised. And I guess that with Malcolm was like, yeah, of course, this is exactly what... Just because you're dead doesn't mean who you were has just disappeared.
Yeah, well, personally speaking, I generally speaking prefer a funeral to a wedding, don't you?
Oh, really? I think I prefer weddings.
Oh, no, weddings, they go on much too
That's true,
long.
They do go on a bit longer. You get better food at a wedding, though, normally.
Yeah, but on the other hand, like with a wedding, you can look at them and think, I'll give it 6 months. I mean, with a funeral...
It's too late.
I mean, let's be honest, this is liable to be permanent.
There's nothing they can do about it. That's true. I do like at funerals... At weddings, you get dance, you get a good dance.
Yeah.
You don't get that at funerals. But at funerals, you get good chat.
Yeah.
You have way better chats with people.
Much better stories.
Oh, yeah, much better stories.
I mean, I've seen some grim, really rubbish best man speeches. But usually, because people are so moved at a funeral.
True.
I mean, I've quite often spoken at funerals just because whoever's... would normally have done it was just too upset, and idea of public speaking as well, as we know for most people, unlike us, is a terrifying prospect.
I think they're
more beautiful and true funerals than weddings.
No, that is definitely.
And there has to be a lot of stuff about, oh, what a lovely outfit, and all of that.
Yeah, I guess also...
There's more bores, in my experience.
Yeah, you're right. No, you're selling me on funerals. you're pointing out to me.
Have you had a wedding?
I have had a wedding,
and was it good?
Yeah, it was good. I reckon
your funeral would be better.
You're probably absolutely right, especially after doing this show.
That's right. You get a big turnout.
Feel so bad. They're like, I spoke to her about death. I probably should go. Have you thought about your funeral?
Not really. Only in some hypothetical sense. My brother thinks about his a lot.
Oh, really?
He's already concocted all the music. But I think, well, in a sense, I'm not there. It should be down to other people.
Yeah, yeah.
Although I have thought of, I could get, I vaguely thought I'd write a bit of a thing to be read after I died, which would start with saying, with me from beyond the grave, hello, I was Arthur Smith, unless there's anybody here from Streatham Tax Office, in which case I was Daphne Fairfax. There's anybody from Streatham Death Duties Office or something, yeah. I've sort of imagined it. I haven't written it, though, it's true. I haven't done all those quick pay now for your funeral thing.
Yeah.
I mean, part of me does think, I'll be dead, what the fuck do I care?
I mean, that's it. There is that argument that it's not for that person.
It's for the people who come after them.
Yeah, unless you have some, strong, you don't want something to happen. Like, have you thought about burial or cremation? Is that something that you'd... Not going to sell you a plan.
Do you know, you should do that as part of this on the side. Do funeral plans, you can make a few quid out of that.
Yeah, more than the podcast.
I think probably I'd... I mean, I am essentially an agnostic / atheist, so frankly you could just shuffle me in a bin bag and put me in with the rubbish in a way, but
I don't know if you can legally do that.
No, perhaps not. I don't know if my partner get in trouble for that. But I suppose cremation probably. I mean, it's funny, isn't it, that there are so many huge graveyards all over the place. I mean, just around London, I went to Sean Hughes, the comedian's funeral a while back in, was that Islington Cemetery? And I'd never been there, and it was, it's quite, you know, somewhere up in, you know, northeast London, but it's enormous.
Yeah.
And you sort of think, well, I don't know, and you look at all the graves and the actual word names of the people on them has kind of faded away into the moss, and they're all higgled. And you think, well, in a sense, just dig it all up and buy flats and build new flats for young people. But, you know, death is a... people have different ideas about it, I guess. And, of course, for a lot of people, that's just the start of something. You know, you're off to heaven and whatnot. Well, I don't know what that's like to you.
No. I mean, so I used to be much more... I mean, you know, I was raised in that sort of Church of England sense. I used to sort of not question it. I'd be like, well, there's heaven. Mm. And I think then when my dad died, it was, you know, and I was 15, it was like, yeah, I'm not sure.
Oh, well, that's a hard age, goodness.
Yeah, yeah. But it does also make you, like you said about your friend at the beginning, kind of go, oh, people just die. That, I think that might just be it.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's hard when I think, like, especially my older relatives, obviously, were like, oh, you know, he's in a good place or something like that. And you think, meh.
Well, you want to believe that. I mean, I'm a bit in Julian Barnes, who said, I don't believe in God, but I miss him.
Yeah, I feel like that. I definitely feel like that. Like, I miss that when I was...
I wish I did believe in God, in a way, because it would make life a lot easier. Death, well, what's the problem? I'm off to some...
Yeah.
Although there's never really any interesting description of what heaven might actually be like.
It's very vague, isn't it? It's very vague.
Again, Julian Barnes had it in his book, History of the World in 10½ Chapters. He describes one of the stories is a man wakes up in this sort of hospital or something. He doesn't quite understand what's happening. He asks for a cup of tea, and a cup of tea is brought to him, and it's the best tea he's ever had in a cup that he'd always loved. And then slowly he realises he's in heaven. He's in a sort of materialist heaven.
Yeah.
And he can eat anything he wants. He gets to sleep with Marilyn Monroe. He plays in the cup final and scores 3 goals in the final. And then it kind of goes on for a bit like this. It's quite a comic. And then he gets to play golf. And he thinks, but of course, eventually he goes round every hole in one because he's in heaven.
He's done it.
At which point he thinks, well, what's the point of golf? There's no point in doing that anymore. And slowly, and you learn that over hundreds of years, everyone chooses eventually to actually die.
Wow.
Because heaven is... I mean, people talk about, you know, immortality is actually a terrifying prospect.
Yeah, absolutely.
And yet people aim for it. I mean, there's billionaires preserving all their old cells and whatnot. But to actually imagine, you know, if you've got another... And would you say it was your 7,922,416,013th birthday? I mean, would you still bother with a card?
It's going to make parties difficult, isn't it? Yeah. The music you like, no one there is going to like. And the food you're into, everyone will be snobby about. You'll be like, we used to all like little quavers. They used to be really popular. Yeah, it'd be weird.
Well, don't worry, you'll become unfashionable soon enough. I'm sure you already are. But
definitely. Yeah, yeah. Thank you, areas. I am, yes. I've already hit that. Yeah, it's weird, isn't it, that... You know, we strive to live as long as we can and we don't want people to die, but it really, like you said, it is as long as your death isn't horrifically tragic and traumatic, it really should be a blessed, it should, and we use that word blessed, it should be the end of a quite happy journey. Did you feel like that with your dad? Did you feel like he'd lived a good life? And...
Yeah, I did. I did. I mean, my only real upsetment was from my mother.
Yeah,
I felt, you know, he got to 81, given that all he'd been through, was not bad, pretty good. And in the actual death, you know, it took place over sort of, it wasn't very long drawn out or anything. So I think, he had a good death, really, in as far as that is possible. I mean, I think, well, my brother's a bit of an expert on these matters. He's a doctor and he's fascinated by death. You know, there's about 4 ways that you die, you know, very suddenly, over a long period, or anyway, he's worked it all out. And and he likes to put the questions to people, well, which of the, these ways would you, prefer to go?
Oh, my God.
I mean, there's something to be said, obviously, for just a sudden...
Yeah. Well, again, like you said, for you, going suddenly, I imagine, is like, well, you don't know. It's about the people around you.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, we talked about it a lot on the show because my dad had cancer for about 3 months, so it was sudden, but it wasn't like heart attack sudden. So
you knew it was coming.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
15, Carrie, that is a horrible idea. What was his name, your dad?
Peter.
Right, well, I should like to raise my coffee
thanks,
here
Arthur.
To Peter.
Oh, thanks. We've never done that before.
I'm sure he would have been happy you were doing this and proud of you.
Oh, you'll get me going. I always joked to my mum he would have been very happy that he was being talked about.
Yeah, good.
I think he would have...
And does your mum listen to this?
Yes, she does.
What's her name?
Ruth.
Ruth. Ruth, here's to you, Ruth.
Oh, yeah, and she's
a
good one.
Ruth and Peter.
Ruth and Peter. Yeah. Oh, Arthur, we've never done this before. This is very nice.
Mm.
Yeah. No, he would have been very chuffed that... I think he definitely would have played that he was the inspiration, you know. Yeah. He would have been very happy that, well, obviously, I'm still worth talking about. So.
What did he do, your dad? What was his...
Oh, my goodness. You've sneakily started interviewing me, Arthur.
Yeah. Well, I've done enough talk.
Yeah. It's weird. I've talked about it before. I don't really know. It was like business.
Mm.
And when I got married, you still have to say what your father's occupation is. And I was at the registry office with my mum and brother, and they said, "And father's occupation?" And I was like, Tom, what should I? And he was like, mum? And she was like, oh, business? Because he sort of worked in like marketing, PR, like he ran his own business from home.
But where were you? Where did you live then?
In North Wales? London.
Oh, no, where? Yeah. There was some Welsh connection.
Oh, so he was Welsh.
Right.
And the name I have is extremely Welsh.
Yes.
But I grew up in North London. And my mum is originally from East London. So I'm quite London-y, but the name Carrie Lloyd really foxes people because they're like, oh, shall I come by Carrie Lloyd? And I'm like, oh, sorry, I'm from the suburbs of North London.
Well, you could do that little bit of Welsh.
I can say, do even shall I come by, which means I can't speak Welsh. So
Anything else you can say?
No, that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't even say that.
Can you say I can speak Welsh?
No. I don't even know which bit of what I'm saying means I can't speak Welsh. Someone just told
Well, that's
me the
way we do a lot of languages.
Yeah.
This is Rashvicha.
What's that?
That's Russian for hello.
Oh, that's
because
good.
I always think, does your ass fit you? Said very quickly. Does your ass fit you?
Does your ass fit you?
Yeah.
Yeah, you there
just
you go.
Hello.
Some Russians listening suddenly went, oh my God.
And I can say, ja, jeg spil kaffe på murslua.
What's that?
That is Danish for I have spilt coffee on the anteater.
I can only say in Danish, hold kæft.
Oh, that's good.
I mean, shut up.
Oh, how'd you like... You obviously had a stroppy Danish friend.
Yeah, I did. Because my mum's best friend is Danish. And her and her daughter would speak Danish to each other. And I'd always hear, Hoi kæft, Claire! That's what I... The only thing
and
I ever
picked
up. And
you did Japanese as well, then, did you say?
So, yeah, well, my sister-in-law's taught me, I know...
Go on.
Kusai, which means smelly. Oh. Because that's what she always says about my brother or one of her sons is around and has been to the bathroom. She's like, kusai. That's what I learned.
Yeah, well,
Japanese
are very cleanly, aren't they?
Yes, I think she is slightly disappointed in the disgustingness of my family.
Have you seen the comedian Yukiro?
I haven't. I've heard of her. No, I haven't.
She does
seen
an hilarious routine about the word ish.
Oh, right.
Which, of course, doesn't really exist in Japanese. She's like, I'll be there at 2-ish.
Yeah,
you
know,
what do you mean? You'll be there at 2 or 3 minutes past. And then we extend it to, did you have a good time? Ish. You know, it's a ridiculous word that is very British.
Very British. Yeah. So, anyway, you're very skilled at this, Arthur.
Do you want me to interview you some more? Tell
no,
me
I don't.
I'm happy
don't.
To do it.
I don't want to. This is like a podcast takeover. It's like, oh, my God, I'm suddenly...
Yeah, I'm moving in. You're being shunted out. I'm taking over.
No one's ever successfully done that before. People have tried, and I'm trying to wrestle it back into talking about death again.
Well, there's more deaths I've known of.
Yeah, sure.
Where I live in this sort of block of flats in South London in Balham, a lady knocked on the door one day and asked to take my picture because she wanted to be a professional photographer. And then she and she took some pictures and she lived there and we had a little bit of a thing and then she went off somewhere else and disappeared and I never didn't see her again. And then about 2 years later, there was a knock on the door and an old lady said, "Hello, I just want to say I knew her name and I'm her mother and she died in a car crash and I've brought these photos back that she took of you."
Wow.
Oh, which was heartbreaking, as you can imagine.
So she wanted to be a photographer. That's why she had that. So she had pictures of you.
Yeah, because I was slightly well known and she thought that would help with her portfolio, I suppose.
God.
I know. And then there was another girl. In fact, if anyone's listening to this, whoever remembers any a girl called Kirby, who used to hang around the comedy circuit a lot in the 80s. And then I didn't see her again. I had a letter from at home that I found. I didn't see her for ages. And then someone said, I don't know if it was true or not, that she died in a car crash as well. Ugh, Kirby. And I never knew, you know.
Yeah.
I suppose that's the case sometimes. People, you know, you hear someone you knew has died and you didn't know. And then.
Yeah, and that is like the life. That's living life, isn't it? It's the process we go through. You lose people. And it's very strange when it's that kind of like you have your pool that's obviously very close to you and that's sort of those distant pools where you're like, oh, that person isn't there anymore. And it doesn't affect me in any shape or form because they weren't in my life. But there's that sort of moment. I think those moments are when you sort of really hit your own mortality because you're like, oh, I mean, that could have been me and there could have been Kirby, someone else being like, oh, bloody hell, I hadn't seen him for ages. Like that weird like, oh, we're all just existing and then we're all going to die. That's all that's going to happen.
I remember in Lucerne, there's this rather fabulous medieval bridge across the mouth of the lake river there. And it's got all these pictures on and it's sort of families. And there's one of an old man who's obviously very old. And then there's the family round him. But then there's death. You know, there's the guy with the scythe. And he's actually going for one of the young ones.
Wow.
You know. Which is a reminder that
it's not,
and especially back then, of course. I mean, it's still the most dangerous day of your life is still your birthday.
Wow,
that's the day you're most likely to die, other than the day you do actually die, I suppose. And if you think back to those times where, I mean, you see it, don't you, so often in graveyards, there's, you know, Mrs. Simpson and Mr. Simpson died, and then there's sort of the names of three people, children who died before they did.
Yeah.
And those parents whose children died before they did, or, you know, that was very common then. I mean, the Brontes, their dad died, all his children had died before he did. I was thinking of him up there in Howarth.
That must have been pretty grim.
Yeah.
Must have been a bit grim.
With that? All your children have died.
It's just, but I think that's the thing, because death, like you said, I think used to be so prevalent and unavoidable. Mm. And it is avoidable now. You can, I guess, in that world of community getting bigger, whereas in the past, perhaps in your village, you would have known Kirby and you would have known what happened to her.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas we move in slightly bigger circles, it feels like.
Well, back, you know, 200 years ago, most people never went more than about 7 miles from where they were born. I always think trains must have been such an extraordinary thing to build.
Yeah.
Wow, you can go that fast and
you
can get to London in 3 hours rather than 5 days on a horse or something.
It would definitely make the Edinburgh Festival smaller if you couldn't.
Yeah.
You had to get on a horse for 10 days.
Yeah.
It would put off a lot of people. You'd be like, really?
Yeah.
You really want to do this?
Yeah.
It's a 10-day horse ride.
I don't know, it was 10. How long would it have been, I wonder, to get to Edinburgh from London on a horse?
I've no idea.
No, nor have I. Yeah, well, let's go with 10 days. Because you've got to stay off overnight at the coaching
You have to stop along the way. Yeah.
And change horses, obviously.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's true. And so do you feel comfortable talking about death then? Do you feel like that's, as it's getting, it is talked about more in society than it used to be? Or is it?
Yes, well, like I say, I have an older brother who is
keen
obsessed
on it.
With death.
Yeah.
And he's endlessly going on about it and suggesting we don't talk about it enough. And I mean, I think there is something to be said for, you know, you don't want to wake up every morning and think, oh, God, I'm going to die.
No, well, you don't.
Even though it's true.
Yeah.
I think there's something to be said for forgetting about it a little bit occasionally. But obviously, who is it? The French philosopher, you know, I can't remember. I've got a really good quote that I can't remember.
I can't remember any. I'm impressed you did a poem, to be honest. I could never even remember one of my own poems.
And death shall have no dominion. do not go gentle into that good night. Old age shall rage and bore, rage against the dying of the light. Yeah, I used to do a Dylan Thomas impression. That was an interesting death, his one.
Yeah.
Drank himself to death in New York. He was like the first big celebrity death, Dylan Thomas. Yeah. Well, I nearly drank myself to death. Oh, you know, in December the 12th, 2001, I woke up with a hideous pain in my stomach and I was went to hospital and I was in intensive care and I was more likely to die than live at that point because I had... God. And this was from drinking.
Yeah, yeah.
Essentially. And... not dying is quite a good feeling, in a way. When you might have done and then you come out of hospital and you just delight and overhearing people laughing at this. I can recommend nearly dying.
it's good for
making
you, out.
You enjoy life and make you realise how lucky you are.
What was it like when you were... Do you remember being in intensive care or anything
like
that?
Yeah, I do. And... I mean, I didn't quite know just how serious it was, although obviously I was in intensive care. They don't just put you in there for a toothache. and I woke up the next morning to see that there was my mother and father and brothers and all sitting around me.
Wow.
And I thought, oh, well, right, this is my deathbed scene.
Oh, my God.
But not dying, like I say, you know, I managed to, I mean, I don't drink anymore and I got diabetes and I've still got certain conditions off the back of it. But nevertheless, it was a kind of rebirth for me as well because I was being too wild, there was no doubt. And it gave me, certainly for a bit, you get a real sense of lightness that, you know, the bearable lightness of being from not dying.
Yeah. I think that's really interesting, isn't it? Because you often see... people who have died in, you know, not even celebrities, I was just thinking about Amy Winehouse, but that kind of thing where you go, sometimes you think, oh, if only they just survived that one thing, perhaps they would have then had another life, another choice, but not everybody gets that. Like, it's just the way
Amy
it works.
Winehouse, I wrote a little poem for her once.
Oh,
I
did
met
you?
Her, yeah. Oh, I do a thing on Radio 4 called Loose Ends where you sit, you know, you're about the distance that you and I are apart is about 2 yards away from. I've seen, you know, I saw Amy Winehouse and, you know, The Clash and Tony Bennett all singing to me as closely as that. It's a really lucky thing.
Did that come after your rebirth, should we say? Like stuff like that?
Yes.
So did you feel like it really did make you go, oh, I'm going to live a bit more in the way that.
Yeah, it did. It was. You know, I did a show off the back of it and it caused me. And then I finally settled down with my lovely partner rather than the sort of wild life I've been leaving before.
I suspect that when it does hit your funeral, there may be some quite good tales to be told.
Yeah, I'm hoping it's a good gig.
Yeah. I think it will be, and it sounds like it's ended in the right way, though. Do you know what I mean? Because I feel like you said, it could have ended 2001, but then going, he was wild, of course it happened. Like,
Well, I hope you're at my funeral rather than I'm at yours, Carrie. Which it seems fairer that way.
Yeah, yeah. I think I'll take that. Mm. I think that'll be nice. Unless we both live to 7,500 million.
Oh, God, can you imagine how rubbish that would be, actually?
We can stand at the back slagging off
I'm
the
sorry,
comic.
I'm busy today, but... How about in January 2714? I'll meet you at 10 a.m.
Yeah, I'll meet you there. We can see who's doing the eulogy and slag them off. Oh, they're no good. I never like them. Well, Arthur, thank you so much for coming
My
to talk
pleasure,
to me.
My pleasure, Carrie.
It was wonderful.
Well, here's to Peter and Ruth.
You can follow Arthur on Twitter at Arthur Smith, but it is spelt, just to confuse you and to make you giggle, at A-R-F-U-R Smith, like Arthur Smith. He's going to be at the Soho Theatre from the 28th of June to the 13th of July. So head to the Soho Theatre website to see him in London, but he's also on tour. Follow him on Twitter, look at his website. You can find all the details of where you should 100% go and see the legend that is Arthur Smith. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast. The show was edited by Kate Holland with thanks to Whistledown Studios, and the music was provided by the Glue Ensemble. And remember, you are not alone.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.